forces of Castro's 26th of July movement, named for the anniversary of his first attack on the regime in 1953, have grown vastly, their power enlarged by captured and surrendered army weapons. Nearly 2 years of hit-and-run warfare, aimed at toppling Batista's government by paralyzing Cuba's economy, culminated in victory as 1958 ended.
It's the 1950s. The president of Cuba is Fulgencio Batista, known as El Hombre, the man. In the early 50s, Batista took full control of the country through a coup. He had backing from the United States and favored foreign investment. U.S. companies owned a huge percentage of Cuba's sugarcane fields, mines, and utilities. Batista eventually invested in public infrastructure and gambling operations.
But there was also corruption and embezzlement. The gap was growing between the rich and the poor. While people in the cities were generally comfortable, their fellow Cubans in rural areas were starving. Batista's secret police tortured and killed his opponents. By the end of 1958, Batista was losing on the battlefields to rebels known as El Movimiento 26 de Julio, or the 26th of July movement. He was also losing popular support in Cuba and backing from the U.S. government.
Then, early in the morning on January 1st, 1959, Batista got on a plane with some of his allies and aides and millions of dollars and fled the country. After years of running Cuba, El Hombre was gone.
I have a neat story about that day because I was 12 years old.
That's Ricardo Gonzalez, who grew up in Camagüey, Cuba. He's a longtime Madison, Wisconsin resident who once served on the city's Common Council and owned the city's iconic Cardinal Bar.
January the 1st is a day of precept in the Catholic Church, meaning that that day you go to Mass. And I was also the altar boy, and so I had to go down to the chapel and set up for the Mass for that day. And as I was leaving my house, I ran into the El Sereno, which is like the night watchman of the neighborhood. And as I came out, he said to me, "Se cayó Batista." Batista has fallen. And I immediately knew what that was about. And I ran down to the chapel and started ringing the bells, you know, pull the rope. And the rope broke. But I got the whole neighborhood awakened to the news that something had happened. And the next thing is I outfitted my bike with a flag of Cuba and a flag of the 26th of July movement, which I made myself, and attached it to my bicycle and went around the neighborhood celebrating the triumph of the revolution.
Batista resigned to prevent more bloodshed and fled the country. Departure touched off wild rejoicing in the capital as the first elements of rebel forces entered Havana.
The leader of that revolution and the government that followed was a young Fidel Castro, the man who would go on to become El Comandante, the prime minister and president of Cuba.
Do you think it is good for the Cuba now, when all the people what want is peace, that the government repair the mistakes and the barbarity of the before government? After 18 years, I am sure many people are going to be tired.
Castro and his revolution are everywhere, and it would change everyone's lives. They promise a revolutionary utopia, but getting there means sacrifice. Some, including many wealthy Cubans, fear the shift to communism and leave almost right away. Like Ricardo's family, they came to the United States in 1960.
Decades later, the changes brought on by the revolution would also lead to 15,000 Cuban refugees coming to Wisconsin as part of the Mariel boatlift of 1980.
Soy Omar Granados.
And I'm Maureen McCollum. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Uprooted. In the last episode of Uprooted, we introduced you to a couple of Cuban men, Enrique Morey and Armando Rodriguez, who left their homes as part of the Mariel boatlift. In this episode, we're looking back on some of the history and societal factors that pushed them and many others onto those boats. Why is this history important, Omar?
Well, it's important because Mariel is the first open public demonstration against the revolutionary government of Fidel Castro. This is also the first time that a generation born within the revolution expresses their disillusionment with that socialist project. So what Mariel and the Mariel Exodus show, in a way, it's perhaps the beginning of the end of the revolutionary utopia of Castro's project.
All right, so back to late 1950s Cuba. While Castro's Cuba was taking shape after the revolution, life abruptly changed for everyone in the country. The shift to communism eventually provided free healthcare, education, and subsidized housing. The government also started regulating and running businesses, redistributing land, and controlling the media.
Cuban citizens had been living as capitalists for decades. All of a sudden, you have this dramatic shift in every process of life.
While the revolution affected everyone, it had a particular impact on young people. And one of those kids was Ernesto Rodriguez, who now lives in La Crosse. When Erne was 10 years old, he and his friends would skip school.
Like, for the mathematics class, I don't like it.
Yeah.
No. I only
no
like...
No addition, no subtraction.
This, I know how to count my money. That's it.
Erne was more into history and geography. So when it was time for math class, he'd take off and go to the river with his friends in Santa Cruz del Sur, Cuba, which is in the Camagüey province.
And we rest, walking with a hand, you know?
Erne and his friends would have handstand races, and money was on the line.
Okay, we bet $1.
So did you ever win one of those races when you were a kid?
Okay, I went like 3 times. The first time I went like $7, because there was only 7 people. The second time, there was 5. The last time, I went like 12 because all the kids want to do it. And you can get the girl.
Erne was a kid at the time, getting the attention of girls and bringing in big bucks by winning handstand races in revolutionary Cuba. Whether 10-year-old Erne knows it or not, the revolution is heavily impacting his life.
Yes, and there's someone I want to bring in to help us understand these changes.
My name is Lillian Guerra, and I'm a professor of Cuban and Caribbean history at the University of Florida.
Lillian has written extensively on Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Latin America. She's lived in Cuba, and she received her PhD in history from University of Wisconsin. She's one of the most prolific historians on Cuba. She says the revolution seeped into every aspect of life.
And so the result is that you have a really intense flourishing of the state in your life and in every nook and cranny of your identity, especially if you're a young person. So the state begins to be a part of your life in a way that's inescapable.
The expectations and goals kept evolving, which was apparent for young people in school. Omar, what was it like being a kid in school in Cuba?
You had to be a pionero por el comunismo, a pioneer for communism. So what that meant was that children were being educated to basically give up your individuality for the common good of the Cuban Revolution.
Now, 1973, suddenly the goal of the school system becomes to develop a communist personality in every child with precise and specific content, unquote. And so that meant not only that you had a real intensification and policing of thought in schools, but you also had schools that divorced you, that pulled you away from your parents deliberately so that you wouldn't have a bourgeois mentality or any legacy of that that could contaminate your ideological commitment to the revolution and to communism.
Lillian Guerra says people were expected to put the revolution first in every aspect of their lives.
And the strategy, the campaign that's in the schools is about what's called perfeccionismo. You know, we already have a very close to perfect society and we just need to perfect it. And the perfection process comes from you, young person. So you are to be the perfect voluntary worker. You are constantly being policed about this by yourself and your peers. You're called on a weekly basis to participate in examinations of conscience called autocríticas, self-criticisms.
So this is probably the biggest contradiction of the revolutionary project brought by Castro. It's selling itself as a transformational project, but it is so limiting for young people. You can't learn about music or the hippie movement or the Beatles. Everything feels predetermined for young people.
In terms of gender, in terms of your willingness and desire to show pride in Blackness, for instance. So I think you get a generation that by the late 70s is sort of fed up with this. And they also have very few choices about what they're going to do, how they're going to dress, what kind of music they can listen to, who they can hang out with, who they can love. And all of that is constantly reinforced and policed, and it is celebrated.
Outside of the classroom, other changes from the revolution were taking hold, like a shift in racial dynamics.
Lillian Guerra says early in the revolution, Castro and the government did something that very publicly addressed race. They desegregated the beaches.
So all beaches in Cuba until March of 59 were private. There were no public beaches that had accommodations sufficient that you could call them a public beach. And so he created this campaign, Playas para el Pueblo, beaches for the people. And around Havana, right out to the east of Havana, the big five beaches that line the highway there are all built in that early period of 1959. And then beyond that, race becomes a major, major factor in how people are perceiving the quality of change. And that means that white racist people who had never had to hang out with Black people were doing so. And some people really found, especially young people, really found this to be the marker, the hallmark of change. Because Cuba had had for more than, or at that point, close to a century, had had this official commitment to destroying racism and had never done it. Every government had avoided it.
Guerra says as the government nationalized places like schools, yacht clubs, and businesses, they were also desegregating them. But more opportunities for Black Cubans came at a price.
And by the way, you destroy all of the Black social clubs and Black mutual aid societies that had really been the pinnacle of Black empowerment for more than a century. You get rid of all those things because the government should be the owner of the economy. The government should control civil society and be the owner, really, of all the organizations that comprise it. So by 1961, when Fidel Castro officially embraces socialism and communism, and Communist Party becomes the primary player in the state, when all that happens, suddenly race and discussing race becomes taboo.
The country was dealing with race, but you weren't really allowed to talk about it openly. So these are the colorblind policies of the Cuban Revolution, assuming that everyone is equal. And that's part of the reason why some Black Cubans became disenchanted.
When you ask the question, why did young Black people in the 1970s want to get the hell out of Cuba? One of the major reasons is that between 1962 and 1980, Black young people that included communists, members of the party, communist youth, revolutionaries, filmmakers, people who identified with the revolution, they want to talk about how it's not just class that drives racism. And it is taboo, and they get themselves in trouble. And when I say get themselves in trouble, some simply get censored for years where they can't write. Some are electroshocked at the National Insane Asylum. Others are put into labor, forced labor camps. These may be just a few hundred people, but they are the leaders of a young, Black, very revolutionary society.
While all this was happening, Erne was busy winning handstand races and laughing with his friends at the riverbanks. He was too young to recognize the shift that was taking place in his society, too young to understand that as a young Black boy, he was being racialized. He had no idea what trouble was in store for him.
Coming up after the break, teenagers in the military.
You're listening to Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio. Secret meetings, deleted documents, and a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The story behind Wisconsin's electoral maps is anything but boring. Hi, I'm Bridget Bowden, co-host of WPR Report's Mapped Out. It's an investigative podcast that gives you the lowdown on Wisconsin's redistricting past and what it means for its legislative future. Get the whole story and subscribe at WPR.org/mappedout or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining me, Maureen McCollum, as we uncover stories of Cuban exiles whose lives were uprooted after the Mariel boat lift. They're bus drivers, fathers, and musicians, sharing their challenges and opportunities of finding a home in Wisconsin. WPR Reports, Uprooted, is made possible by listener contributions. Your gift now at WPR.org/donate ensures you and your community have access to high-quality journalism and storytelling. Before the break, we were talking about the Cuban Revolution and how it would soon impact people like Ernesto Rodriguez, a Wisconsinite who grew up in Cuba. He didn't realize it yet, but his life was being shaped by the revolution.
Yeah, the revolution sees youth as the backbone of their production force. That means you have to give up your individuality to instead produce for the revolution. You have to become good at technology. You have to be part of a working force that is thinking about developing the country. Now, in the 1970s, the revolution is still young and inexperienced. Then a number of programs that implement the lives of young people, like Escuela al Campo.
And in English, that means school in the countryside. What was the idea here?
Well, it starts as early as 1966. And it's become a major part of Cuban educational policy. So what that means is that all urban junior high students are expected to spend time in the countryside. This was mostly to educate you on the love for your country, realize the value of labor, and more specifically, to remove the differences or disparities between urban and rural in order to establish more links between school life and work life, educating a generation of children that would eventually work for the revolutionary project.
So what was it like when you were at Escuela del Campo?
Oh, you had to pick whether it was tobacco or fruits or vegetables, and you went there for a month or 45 days separated from your family. Here you are, you're 13 years old, you're in the middle of discovering your sexuality, and you have no idea how to use a machete or what's best for any of the crops that you're working on. So this is definitely bad for production, but the government saw Escuela al Campo as a fully educational experience to teach you the importance of labor, community, and the social commitment that you were expected to have.
So what are some memories that stick out to you when you were at Escuela al Campo?
Oh, one memory I have from Escuela al Campo is the famous wooden suitcase. So because food was so scarce, you had to bring all your food and lock it up with a big lock that could not be broken into or cut in a wooden suitcase, which was, as you can imagine, very difficult to carry. So your family would visit you every Sunday and bring you supposedly all the snacks that a 13-year-old needs for the week that they could find in the middle of the scarcity that we were living through in the 90s. But the other use that the suitcase had was to play congas and rumba at night, because here you have this wooden suitcase and it's party time.
All right. Another experience that impacts Cuban teenagers' lives is obligatory military service. Boys had to serve the government in some way, including time with the Cuban army. And this is something that's still required today. Here's Professor Lillian Guerra again.
Military preparation is something that you do from the time you're a child. You pick up guns, they may be unloaded, but you learn how to use them. In 1974 through the 80s, the Ministry of the Armed Forces had a special program where they actually embedded different members of local bases into schools. They were called the padrinos, the godfathers of these schools. And so that the kids, from the time that they're in first, second, third grade forward, would have direct contact with members of the military, would not question military service, would see the military and intelligence forces as true representatives of liberation and not true representatives of foreign policy interests or repression of civil liberties domestically.
Yeah, I grew up in Havana and I had to serve in the Cuban army before college, but there was a dramatic difference between what serving in the army looked like in the 70s versus the 1990s. The threat of the United States invading Cuba in the 1970s was far more real. Also, the economic needs of the country in the 1970s were much more demanding, which means the army became a workforce.
Another person that had to serve in the army was Rodosvaldo Pozo, better known as Nino. He also lives in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and actually lives with Erne, the handstand champ. They're practically brothers, and both grew up in Cuba's Camagüey province.
I was kind of a little mischievous, like a little guy said, she born this way, you know.
That's right. Nino says he was born this way, just like Lady Gaga. Despite his mischief, Nino was a smart student. He comes from a big family from Florida, also in Camagüey. He has 11 brothers and sisters. His dad was a band conductor, and his mom took care of the house.
You love your mama.
I do.
What's her name?
Isabel. Isabel Pozo Sánchez. And my father, René Carmenate Estrada, they all was good to me.
But his parents, Isabel and René, got divorced when Nino was a teenager.
But they used to get along. Even though my mama married somebody else, they all used to get along each other. That's the one thing that my family taught me, to love and be kind.
To love and be kind. Once Nino became a teenager, he joined the Cuban army. He wasn't psyched about being in the military, and he wasn't a fan of the country's communist leadership.
I don't agree with the government or anything. I was in the army. You know, they accused me to do sabotage against the government.
An officer accused Nino of sabotaging or destroying sugarcane fields with a Molotov cocktail. As part of his military service, this was a crop he was supposed to protect.
They said that I was burning sugarcane, that I was throwing fire in the police. They gave me 26 years in prison. So I was mad about it, that. And I was in a solitary confinement for many years.
Did you do it or did they make it up?
Well, I don't like the Cuba government.
Sure.
So okay. I played the first.
Got it.
And this was a big deal, since the Cuban government traded sugar with the Soviet Union in exchange for everything.
I said, no way. I never got a sugar. Yeah. I told her, I'm not going to get a sugar with no communist.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, the sugar that I got was for eating.
Nino was a teenager when he was sent to prison for 26 years for allegedly burning sugarcane fields in the army.
Well, I cut a lot of sugarcane. A lot.
Erne, Nino's roommate in La Crosse, also had to cut sugarcane for 10 hours a day as part of his teenage military service.
From 6 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And yeah. Then you go take a shower and go to class from 5 o'clock until 9 o'clock at night.
Oh.
And then go to sleep. If you keep it talking,
you get a ticket. You get a ticket. They write you up.
They take you the pass
to
go home or send you to the disciplinary unit.
Erne ended up being disciplined for something else, something the army thought was far worse than talking to his friends after lights out. When Erne was 18 years old and serving in the military in Camagüey, his father died on the opposite end of the island, in Havana. He had to miss the funeral.
Because when my father died, they don't give me a pass to go to see my father until my father was buried. 4 days later. Then I went to La Habana. They showed me where my father was buried. I went over there and they only gave me 5 days.
Once Erne got home, he only had a few days off to mourn. Then he had to turn around and get back to his military unit. But the government hadn't given him enough money to cover the return trip. He could only afford to take the bus partway.
And then I only have $5 in Havana. I went to the bus stop and I asked the clerk, how far I can get with $5?
If Erne didn't make it back in time, he would be disciplined. Not to mention, he was starving.
Hungry. I started walking. I see a bike. I look everywhere. not seen nobody. Go, oh no, I can get the bike, go to where I had to go, and then
leave
I can send her a bike or...
I mean, leave it with this.
Or leave it over there. Before I get out of the city.
Police pulled Erne over, and he was taken to Kilo Siete prison because he'd taken a bike to try to make it back to his military post in time.
Send me to the jail cell. After 11 months I was there, I told the people there, look, I don't kill nobody. I only steal the bike because I want to go to my unit. I don't want to get in trouble. I got in trouble. They take me to Kilo Siete, and about 3 hours later, they call my name. There you go. You can go free.
Nino was also at Kilo Siete at that time, serving his sentence for the alleged sugarcane incident. This is where the two friends first met.
Their punishments may seem severe, but they align with the Cuban government's wishes for a crime-free society. Professor Lilian Guerra says that attitude towards crime disproportionately affected Black Cubans.
So in this landscape of social dangerousness, Black people are targeted more than whites because there is a long-standing belief in Cuba that Blacks are natural criminals. And so in the 60s, late 60s through the 70s, you have work camps and schools that are set up to deal with what the Cuban government calls pre-delinquents, predelincuentes, who turn out to be like 80% Black. You know, they're like little kids, 12, 13, 14, who have high absentee rates from school. You know, it's all the kind of classic symptoms. They have the classic symptoms of families that live on the edge, that live in marginal communities. They don't want the state to tell them what they can be doing, whether they can be selling something or not selling something, whether they can make cheese or ham in their house, whether they can worship the saint they want to worship. And the state's intrusion into the lives of slum dwellers, former slum dwellers, most of whom are Black, creates, we can say, the conditions for the state to see that the real problem here for the state is going to be those young people. They need to be re-educated. And so the culture itself and the context itself is one that creates a dynamic of push factors and alienation and exhaustion from all of this by 1980.
That exhaustion and alienation was real for Erne and Nino, who started 1980 in prison. But it was real for people who weren't incarcerated too. Despite all the government's promises, they were left trying to survive, trying to provide for their families, find food, get money.
Some had seen family members leave and they wanted to reunite. People wanted to travel and see the world and they couldn't leave the country. This expectation that society had to serve the revolution, some Cubans were tired of it.
They were beginning to realize that the revolution was not for them. They had to get out. In the next episode, pressure builds and Cubans find a way out through the walls of an embassy in April of 1980.
And in a matter of 3 hours, the simple news, unexpectedly, without any preparation, that an embassy was open, provoked, to the horror of the Peruvian ambassador, a wave of people.
Within 24 hours, 10,000 people jammed the embassy.
And that eventually leads to Erne and Nino leaving prison
and making their way to the port of Mariel.
I told my brother, man, I gotta leave, man. You know, I don't got no choice.
And then when they asked me, you wanna get out of Cuba? Well, yeah. I said, okay. And then next day in the morning, about 8 o'clock, they put me in the line and said, okay, you see the boat over there? Get in there.
That's next time on Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio. Uprooted is reported, written, and produced by me, executive producer Maureen McCollum, along with Omar Granados. Our producer and technical director is Brad Kohlberg. We're edited by Brady Carlson. Music direction and composition by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich, Peter Bryant, Hannah Haynes, and Ezra Wall. Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. The digital design team is Jane Jumale, Amanda Starich, and Anna Rudin. Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major, and special thanks to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Murphy Library for archival photos. Artwork by Grace Lorenz. Our theme music is the song Bozo Part 3 by Willie Chirino. Additional music from La Familia Valera Miranda. Archival audio from NPR's Research, Archives, and Data Strategy team. You can see more at wpr.org/uprooted.